You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Hello, listeners. Today's podcast will feature me discussing underground warfare. Hope you enjoy it. All right, welcome back, listeners. We're going to do one of those episodes where I give a discussion about something. If you've listened to my Urban Warfare 101 and my Why is Urban Hard podcast, you'll have a feel of what this will be. Today, I want to talk to you about underground warfare, an underground warfare 101 class that I gave recently at our world famous 40th Infantry Division Urban Planners Operations course, or Urban Operations Planners course. You know what I mean. So let's get to it. Subtraining warfare, what is it? What are the basics that I would want people to know for any operations? Well, let's start with the definition. But before I can start the definition, I need to tell you where I'm getting all of this. And sorry for all my other Urbanista brothers, both my Canadian, Jason Giroux, my British, Stu Lyle, Drew Craig. I'm going to talk mostly in U.S. doctrine, U.S. Preparedness, U.S. thoughts towards underground warfare. So if you're a member of the U.S. military, for subtraining operations, the girth of doctrine is one manual. But that's fine. It's really good. And I'll tell you a little bit about how it was developed. But the manual that, if you wanted to follow along, is Army or ATP 3-21.51, Subtraining Operations, dated November 2019. But that's it. It's really good. You can get it where you get all your doctrine. All right, 101, if you remember from my Urban Warfare 101, we know in the wooded areas, we know the five major terrain features, the three minors. We can tell a lot about the construction, how to form fighting positions. For the urban environment, not so much, and for the subterranean, definitely not. But that's what this podcast is for, is to explore all those intricacies. So let's start off with definitions, because for urban warfare, especially for urban, if you go back, you know that urban is defined by the triad for now, which is complex man-made terrain, a population, and infrastructure to support it. So what are the definitions for subterranean operations? Unfortunately, there's not any definitions. So I went to Google like everybody else. Subterranean means existing, occurring, or done under the Earth's surface. As a founding member of the International Working Group on Subterranean Warfare, we decided in our first meeting and conference that subterranean, underground were used synonymously. So you can use interchange those, and we can add tunnel. So if you say subterranean warfare, underground warfare, or tunnel warfare, it's the same definition. It means under the ground. So what's next? So there, according to doctrine, our doctrine, there are three categories of subterranean, which I think these are really important to would be the foundational knowledge that I talk about in my podcast. So what are the three categories? Category one, tunnels, caves, and natural cavities. They can be either rudimentary or sophisticated, and we'll talk each one of them. So category one, tunnels, caves, and natural cavities. Category two, urban subsurface systems, either substructures or civil works. And then you have category three, military-purposed underground facilities, either shallow or deep. But this is really the heart of it. So let's break those down of the different types or categories of underground. So that category one, which is the tunnels, caves, and natural cavities. It includes both rudimentary and sophisticated systems. So if you think about a rudimentary system, that means one that doesn't have any support, what we call shoring, the things that keep the tunnel from collapsing on itself. And even if it does have shoring, it's usually made of wood and brick and things like that to prevent structural collapse. Some tactical tunnels and that exist within very solid rock. Like if you think about Hezbollah tunnels in southern Lebanon, which I have actually been in one, it was dug straight into the rock. So it has its own kind of structural integrity. Other tunnels and caves are maybe unstable and prone to collapse. Now, a sophisticated system will have shoring despite the type of surrounding and geology, usually containing basic amenities such as drainage, electricity, and ventilation. So on top of the shoring, it'll have all that sophisticated stuff like power outlets, power cords, lighting, ventilation shafts, drainage, pumps. And if you think about a Hamas tunnel in Gaza, many of those have been discovered and they have, you know, air conditioning and fans. And that would be a category one sophisticated tunnel with that lighting and the power and all of that. So got it. Category one, both rudimentary and sophisticated. Category two is your urban subsurface systems. They're divided into two areas, substructures and civil works. And this includes, you know, stuff that's built into the underground, like basements and shelters and parking garages, similar to sophisticated tunnels, but they're more robust with complex supporting infrastructure, like an underground parking garage. Now, civil works, so that was their substructures. So think those, you know, underground parking lots and things like that. A civil works, though, which especially in urban areas, include those aqueducts, sewers, subways, transportation, utility tunnels, all of that. And they have complex supporting infrastructure with ventilation. Many urban subterranean systems may withstand military strikes because of the depth, like my experiences in Ukraine going to the Battle of Kyiv. Many of the civilians sought refuge in the subway tunnels. And one of Kyiv's subway tunnels is the second deepest, only next to one in North Korea. So they gave a lot of protection to the civilians. The depth and type of material and the construction, and there's some huge ones in New York City I've been into, but they vary. In, you know, same thing during World War II, in London, the civilians escaped the Blitz by going into the metro system. So category two, urban subsurface systems broken up into the superstructures, you know, those basements and parking garages and things, but those also those major civil works. And lastly, you know, military people, military purposed underground facilities. So those are those sophisticated, complex structures specifically designed to be built unobserved and provide maximum protection. So to hide military, whether it's in, you know, think about the old Cheyenne Mountain nuclear command and control center that could withstand a nuclear hit. This gives people a lot of concerns. There are a lot of these, and militaries do this. North Korea, China, they have underground naval bases, underground cities for military purposes. Now, in this category, this category three, there's only three underground facilities, like military purpose. They can either be shallow or deep. That's the only two classification. A shallow is 20 meters or less. Examples might be a silo, a cut and cover facility. Basically, you dig a trench and then you cover it. And now you have a military purpose underground facility, depending on how deep you go. A deep one would be a facility more than 20 meters. So examples like protection sites for government officials, military operational facilities, and research and production facilities for WMDs. So the next 101 is, what are the different functions of underground in war specifically? And the doctrine kind of breaks it for the enemy, but you know, I think one of the challenges here is that we only think about the underground, John Spencer's opinion, as an obstacle or something we're attacking into. When I studied many of the modern battles, you see people using them for protection, like in Kyiv in the opening moments. The 72nd Mechanized Brigade moved its headquarters into a subway terminal. And there are a lot of considerations when you do that for communication and things like that. But we can't always think of them as only the enemy's asset. And I'll talk about that later. But from the doctrinal perspective, there are a few functions that the enemy may use the subterranean. So he may use them for command and control and include systems related to enemy command and control, communications, computers, and intelligence. He may use them for operations, as we have seen in war a lot, using them as passageways to move between two locations, to stage military operations, conduct reinforced defensive networks and bunkers and tunnels and fighting positions. I may use them for production. And we've seen those, I've seen those even in Gaza with deep buried rocket production plants they found. But that's another reason why they'll use them to for the production of equipment and munitions in government laboratories out of sight and in observation. The enemy may use them for storage, like we see Hezbollah doing with their rockets. They store many of their rockets underground, but there may be climate control issues and things like that in a facility that's meant for storage. And then lastly, the last function we protection. So subterranean structures could be used to protect civilians or government officials for military sakes. It also applies to combatants, non-combatants, because that's like we were talking about where civilians may go underground. Other common, so those are the functions of sub-T's, but common uses, so our doctrine breaks them down into, you know, state actors and non-state actors, where a state actor may use a tunnel or underground facility for strategic reasons, right? So that's where they're going to put their strategic national assets, such as WMD storage, critical command and control nodes, and other assets of strategic value. So our doctrine calls those strategic underground facilities. And of course, we have three layers. So we'd have operational underground facilities, which would be, you know, primarily for the military, to, like North Korea, to put their long-range hardened artillery sites in, or in China for their coastal defense missiles. And then lastly, which we see a lot of actually in urban warfare, is these tactical underground facilities, like the ones in North Korea for tactical capabilities along the border with South Korea, or in Gaza, in southern Lebanon, to move around. Now, our doctrine does have a non-state actor category who says that they may have capabilities, and we'll talk about some of that evolution here in a minute, but where they might have that evolution of using some of these layers, you know, the tactical, operational, and maybe even strategic, which we have seen Hamas do. But we saw, Taliban using them and things like that. So now, I didn't want to do a separate episode for why is underground warfare hard. We could, but I'm trying this out as a one-on-one, and you let me know if you want to, more detail. And I've done a couple past episodes with like one of the world's leading tactical, experts, Sergeant Major retired Joe Vega. But in a general sense, like, why is sub-T hard? Why does John Spencer include it part of my research agenda? Is because it's more, people view it as, okay, it's just going underground, got to surface, I may need to go underground, but it's not like that. It's more like going from being surface warfare, naval surface warfare on the surface of the ocean, and then going underground where there is no similarity. Everything's different. Everything you have on the surface level doesn't work underground. So let's go through a couple of those. Like, why is sub-T hard? Well, you can't breathe underground. And most subterranean, not all of them are the same as we just went through the different categories, and sophistication and ventilation and things like that. But in general, I mean, in some of these, you have to have a self-contained breathing apparatus to be safely breathing the right air, oxygen, and other things. So you can't breathe underground. You can't shoot underground. The concussion for shooting or things exploding underground is compounded. You should have double ear protection just to shoot underground, and you can blow your eardrums. You can't move underground. So everything that a military would have for the surface that would use GPS, if that's what they primarily would use, it won't work underground, right? It doesn't have it. The underground also canalizes you more so than even urban. So your ability to move isn't the same as the surface. Your ability to communicate, all the equipment that people have for line of sight, satellite communication doesn't work underground. You have to have special equipment. Command and control, maintaining awareness of where formations are underground, because you don't have all that C2 assets or command and control assets, it's harder. It's much different. The be able to survive underground. The psychological impacts, and I'll talk a little bit about that later, is the hazards, but not everybody can even psychologically perform underground. You can get soldiers that get claustrophobia, that get vertigo, that lose sense of time, don't know up from down. The medical, even mental and physical cost of either breathing through a self-contained breathing apparatus or just being underground, and the temperatures can change. Just to survive underground is different than the surface and much harder. Readiness. So, in order to train underground, there are things like confined spaces, trainers, and things like that. I won't get into that, but just to maintain readiness, it's for the underground, it's really hard. Rules of engagement and law of war. I have a dear friend of mine that wrote the book, which I highly recommend, called Underground Warfare, that dives into a lot of the law of war perspectives, especially with cross-border tunnels or the presence of a tunnel, when the rules of engagement, when you don't really know what's in the tunnel, like we're seeing as we're speaking, where there may be civilians or hostages in a tunnel. And then lastly, one of the reasons it's hard is because of us, as it always is, whether we prioritize it, whether we believe we'll see it on the battlefield or not. So those are the reasons why it's hard. I wanted to double tap because the book, The Doctrine, does have some really good information on the hazards, right? Not that every hazard's insurmountable, but there are definitely some very lethal hazards underground, especially, let's go through some of them, like the environmental and basically air hazards, right? The air quality down there, the smoke that can be underground. If there's a fire, how that fire or explosion will suck out the oxygen from the underground space and could lead to then chemical injury. If there's anything running underground, the vehicle generators, things like that, you have the carbon monoxide, you have hydrogen sulfide, methane. I've seen experiments where vehicles don't even work because the vehicle needs, through air coming in through the manifold, and there's just not enough down there. So if the space doesn't have adequate ventilation, depending on what you're doing, you may have to pump in your own, bring it with you. Just the environmental hazards are huge underground. Even in Gaza, in late 2023, there was an IDF soldier who died from contracting a fungus. And they're actually a total of 10 soldiers, but one of them died from a fungus that they believe was from a soil that had contaminated with sewage. And there's plenty of historical examples of actually fighting through sewers. So that level of, this fungus killed the IDF soldier. So material hazards, if we're talking about like a category 3, where there's deep buried military structures, maybe a facility for laboratories or missile launch sites, rocket fuel, toxic chemicals, CBRN items, material hazards that may be down there. Structural hazards. So, like we said, with those different category 1 tunnels and cavities, the structural integrity isn't always assured. And soil's heavy. Especially if somebody dug a tunnel haphazardly, A single cubic foot of soil weighs 100 pounds, which is just wild. I talked to you a little bit about the psychological hazards, but you know, just the darkness and disconnection from the surface can really affect individual soldiers. And it may be like the must go gung-ho soldier you got. Entering that space will affect every soldier's ability to do their job differently. And you know, God forbid, if it's a hostage being held in there a long time, it has very significant psychological impacts. And then lastly, of course, tactical risk of even going underground, command and control, what's in the tunnel, a lot of risk and hazards. Okay, but every tunnel will be different. The intelligence, the preparation may be different or versus the one you just find. And every task that the military soldier in underground warfare will be different. So there are a list of tasks I added to it that are in the doctrine, such as the task to locate a tunnel, to map a tunnel, control, contain, isolate it, interdict it, neutralize a tunnel. If you just you just want to neutralize it to continue mission, clear a tunnel, which is really what the subterranean operations doctrine manual is. Majority of it is about once a tunnel being known and then entering it and clearing it and all the planning considerations and equipment that you'll need for that, which I don't find in the doctrine, but I'll talk to you. It became a really big problem in Gaza is the tactical task to destroy a tunnel. So those are some of them that, but this isn't the first time, like today, as I'm talking to you, isn't the first time that people have faced tunnels in warfare. It's as ancient as warfare itself. I mean, going, Battle of Jerusalem, which I have a podcast on, I highly recommend it, or, biblical, really a biblical level of underground warfare in many instances, catacombs in Rome, like you name it. From a U.S. military perspective, dates back to the Civil War, battles in Vicksburg, Mississippi, or of course the Battle of Crater in Petersburg, Virginia, where they, the Confederates try to dig a tunnel to blow the Union up, and it didn't go very well. You have, of course, you had World War One with tunnels in the mezzanine, large tunnel bombs. You had mining and counter mining. You get to World War II, you have like Iwo Jima, where the Japanese tunneled into volcanic rock, which was interesting because in those tunnels, because of that volcanic rock, it could go up to 100 degrees in those things. And it caused a big challenge. It was a part of their strategic plan to hold the island chains. You get to, after World War II, then you get to Vietnam. So for an American perspective, probably one of the most large scale interacting with the subterranean environment and subterranean warfare is Vietnam. Infamously, the tunnels of Cu Chi, which were over 155 miles of tunnels, leading from Cu Chi to Saigon or even the border with Cambodia. By the end of the Vietnam War, there were over 4,800 documented tunnels used by the Viet Cong. And that did cause a change, right? The U.S. military adapted to having to, that would be present in the environment and be a major challenge. So they created a tunnel rat specialty. So at first, just voluntold, people, but then they actually created a school with the School of Engineers, and they developed tactics for it, both for the tunnel rats who are trained, but also there's a really good video where just a tutorial for what you do in Vietnam when you find a tunnel, everything from trying to neutralize it with just dropping two grenades into it to a walkthrough of, you need at least two guys to take their gear off. They have a flashlight and a pistol, to other ways to neutralize it, which is in my research about tear gas. If you've ever heard me talk, it was in the tunnels of Vietnam that I find kind of the start of the tunnel, the tear gas myth and evolution. The U.S. soldiers would dump tear gas powder into a tunnel and then try to cover it. You'll collapse the top of it. They would actually pump tear gas by generators into the tunnels. They also had in the tutorial how the U.S. military would use explosives, line charges, and others to get to the tunnels. After Vietnam, of course, the tunnels don't go away. It's for many reasons, for defensive purposes. In the late 1970s, we see tunnels and popping up in North Korea, North South Korea, as North Korea was tunneling invasion tunnels into South Korea. I actually got to go to one of those in Tunnel 3. You can go if you so want to as a tourist. But they found these very large tunnels, over a mile long, 6 feet high, 6 feet wide, 240 feet below the earth, meant to flow massive amounts of troops from North Korea into South Korea. They say like estimate like 30,000 troops per hour, but pretty fascinating stuff. The next time though, there's actually a blip in the U.S. military's work on underground warfare. Of course, there's lots of projects and special programs, and there's a decade long cooperation with Israel, who faces underground warfare. It has faced underground warfare, both cross-border tunneling and now in actual operation. So there's been like a 10-year U.S.-Israeli cooperation program for mining and counter-mining and sharing information. But in 2017, the U.S. Army spent $500 million to train most of the brigade combat teams. There were like 26 of 31 at the time in mobile training teams of subterranean warfare. And Joe Vega, who I've had on the show, was one of the leads for that, both basically an operator program, but an engineer MTT and a leader MTT. But that was done because they basically looked at some of the extent of North Korean tunnels and realized that just having special operations forces having that capability, that we need to have some capability in the general force. So they did this MTT. It was great. It ran for that duration, that year, and then it went away. It transitioned to an actual class online that you can take, so you can go find that and to do it as much as you want. Since then, of course, the U.S. military has had experience in war with underground, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. With Iraq, military, all the categories, actually category one through three, Afghanistan with the caves and tunnel complexes like Tora Bora. And then in 2017, in Afghanistan, we dropped the mother of all bombs. So 22,000 pound bomb, 11 tons of explosives on a ISIS tunnel complex in Afghanistan. We saw it starting, and this is a big part of the book Underground Warfare by Daphne Richmond Barak, where she goes into really the explosion of ISIS using tunnels in Iraq and Syria to include tunnel bombs. They dug in Aleppo, I think it was. They dug a 300-meter tunnel in 30 days, packed it full of explosives, and successfully blew up underneath a hotel that had been used as a command and control center. I saw tunnels to include Category 3 when I went into Nagorno-Karabakh. So during the 2020 war, there was the presence of underground warfare, the 2020 Nagorno-Karabakh war. I went there in 2021. You get to Ukraine, of course, the subterranean featured prominently. If you remember the Battle of Mariupol, where the underground of the Azovstal steel plant allowed a 1,000-plus fighters to hold Russians for two very long time. The tunnels and basements of Bakhmut caused a very protracted in Soledar. Now there's Russians tunneling into Ukrainian trench lines. So the underground's there in the biggest wars in Europe since World War II. And then, of course, Gaza, if you've listened to some of my shows or read some of my publications, You know, new estimates are that there's over 450 tunnels, 450 miles of tunnels in Gaza. I have been there. I've been into a one that ran 2.5 miles. You could drive trucks through it, had all the sophisticated tunnel networking that's there. They found over five, you know, probably it was an estimated, there's an estimated 6,000 tunnel shaft entrances in Gaza, just nothing that any military has ever faced, especially where they're dug underneath the, but they're there, right? Southern Lebanon is called the land of tunnels, where they have, you know, the geology is different. Of course, every one of these locations, the geology is different. So the, how easy is it to dig, how structural integrity of the tunnels. But in Southern Lebanon, as we're speaking, many facilities underground that Hezbollah invested a lot of money into. Now, from a kind of state actor perspective, China is estimated to have 3,000 miles of tunnels and bunkers capable of withstanding nuclear attacks, and networks that they call the Underground Great Wall. And in North Korea, there's an estimate of, and sometimes these estimates are actually lower than what they actually are, estimates of 5,000 miles of tunnels. And infrastructure includes multiple underground air bases with runways, radar sites, and submarine ports inside mountains. So not only have we seen tunnels, we've seen an increase of tunnel warfare, but you can predict if anything happened. Now, the doctrine manual does go into actual planning considerations for attacking in underground facilities. I won't read it. It's there. It's a great resource. A lot of work was put into it. I mean, like command and control, you know, how do you, your planning considerations for reduced situational awareness, the changes in the rules of engagement that you have to consider, the movement and maneuver, the timeline of what it takes if you're attacking or entering a tunnel, mission abort criteria. It's a really good list. If you know there's going to be underground in the environment that you're going into, I highly recommend checking out the doctrine, and especially these planning considerations. Intelligence, like what would be the intelligence, like the structural integrity, the presence of dual use or civilians in tunnels, the purpose of an underground facility. And there's a lot of lessons coming out of Gaza where there has been a paradigm shift, and even the IDF, who had the world's only basically force, the Yahalom, which is, you know, the weasels, their only force at a brigade level, trained, manned, equipped, research and development for underground warfare. And of course, they were vastly unprepared for Gaza, but they have completely done a paradigm shift in the war in Gaza, which I plan to finish a paper on, where they started with enter at the last cause, but they have transitioned to the tunnel is, can be used for maneuver. And they are the first military I've ever seen maneuvering forces underground at the same time they're moving forces on the surface to actually do maneuver warfare on two levels of the earth, under the surface and at the surface. And there's, I will write about, it's just a complete paradigm shift. And, you know, it removed, because of, you know, necessity being the mother of all innovation, they had to figure out how to do that. They had to learn how to identify what type of a tunnel it was by entering it. They had to push down capabilities, much like that $500 million that we spent. They realized that they couldn't rely on just the special forces engineers, those Yahalom weasels. They had to push down to every soldier's ability to identify, is it a tunnel? What is it, a tactical tunnel? Does it go between two buildings, or is it something bigger? How do you identify all that? They had to push that down. So a lot of lessons are going to come out of that are going to be very, very important. I wanted to go over quickly, as you know, a lot of my, in our course in California, some of the podcasts aren't necessarily about giving you all of the answers. Really, you know, of course, I want to give you a foundation, but I want you to have the ability to ask the right questions. So, you know, I wanted to go through a couple of the tasks with some of the, you know, some of the things we know about some of those tasks, like locating subterranean environments. You know, all forms of intelligence can be used to assist in locating underground networks, whatever category it is, aerial, geo intelligence, of course. You can if there's disturbed earth, SIGINT, you know, if there's digging, radar, you know, ground penetrating radar, there's a way to drill and look for it. And what we find, what they've found in Gaza, a very, very big part of locating tunnels, even being on it, and all three times that I've been in Gaza, and I'll be there again, you know, basically everywhere you walk, there's a tunnel underneath you. So human intelligence through being able to, like, you might want to go look over there again, because even the operations was covering tunnels that might have been seen when military operations weren't occurring. So locating a tunnel, there are some nuances there, but there are ways to do it to include aerial signature of tunnel presence. Mapping, you know, once you locate and go through the other tasks, but mapping is a challenge that a lot of people have invested in. I was a part of the DARPA Subterranean Challenge, which is a 5-year program to create robotics that could enter a tunnel for the whole spectrum of combat and quickly map it and report back if the presence, you're basically the map of it, but also the presence of things in it. That did output. There was somebody who won that. So if somebody really wanted to go look, and you could find that in Gaza, they relied some on dogs with the GoPros on them. There is a field expedient way that has concerns about using smoke, like a colored smoke, and you put the smoke down it, and it may pop up and show you where it came from, or water, which we'll talk about in a minute, that will show you where it comes out. Another challenge is neutralizing the tunnel, right? So depending on the combat situation, the mission, what it is a clearing, raid, you name it, there may be presence of a tunnel that you just need to neutralize, or it can't be used, can't be left to your rear. Like I told you, the Vietnam, you know, crude solution was you drop 2 grenades down it. I reported earlier in the world about this really expanding foam that they had, which is I called it a SpongeBob, and it caused for a little kerfuffle in the news because it looks like a SpongeBob. It's just expanding foam, but it's a little bag that you would like shove down a sewer entrance, and it would, you'll seal it up for a very temporary amount of time. They're not using it anymore. And there is some element of, you know, being able to collapse, whether it's something on top of the entrance, if it's just about neutralizing it. But the big challenge, which has really become the tactical task challenge for Israel and Gaza, but, you know, for any military, I think, depending on what the mission is about the tactical task of destroy the tunnel. And how do you really destroy a tunnel? I won't go into specifics because it was necessary in Gaza, but it definitely became a very big challenge. So what are the ways that we know you can really destroy a tunnel? Of course, you have aerial munitions, so bunker busters. Like I talked about that, you know, the mother of all bombs was dropped in Afghanistan in 2017. In an urban environment, that's going to be, you know, not an option. But there is a variety of aerial munitions with a certain penetration depth, and leaders and planners should know those depths, whether it's a 2,000-pound bomb, which can penetrate, you know, depending on the variant, 30 feet under, you know, 16 meters or 30 feet underground, or there are a few other types. But, you know, that's one option, is right, a bunker buster or a large diameter munition to penetrate the earth, depending on the context. And whether it's available, you could use wet cement. So in the tunnels that Israel found in 2009, they found tunnels in across crossing into the border, And they, one of the instances, they filled it full of wet cement because they couldn't go to where it led to in southern Lebanon, and it came out. That was actually, interestingly, the same way that the South Koreans did to those North Korean tunnels, invasion tunnels they found. They poured, they blocked them off with cement. I don't know if you call that a destroy or a neutralize. Probably a neutralize. Now, flooding came about in the war against Hamas in Gaza, but it was actually used earlier by Egypt in 2017-ish, 17, 16, 17, 18, where they were destroying what has become not all of them, but many tunnels along the Gaza-Egypt border, and they used both seawater and sewage to do that. And because there was no of the shoring that we talked about, some of those collapsed, but they've of course found some that were there. But in this war, in the war against Hamas and Gaza after October 7th, Israel tried it. So they brought in 5 industrial level pumps and pumped both seawater and fresh water into the tunnels to assist with clearing booby traps and flushing fighters out. It worked very minimally in a couple locations, but it basically didn't work. Definitely didn't destroy, because they're Hamas tunnels have, you know, concrete size, concrete arches are very, in many ways, there are a lot of them are uniform. So, you know, there's no collapsing of it. So the water wasn't destroying it. And, you know, many of them had drainage capabilities, or just would seep back into the earth. So that flooding option to destroy or even to neutralize maybe had some minor elements of clearing. But what they've really found is, yeah, really the only way to destroy a tunnel is through explosives. But then if you go to a place like Gaza, where there's hundreds of miles of tunnels, is that feasible? Gaza in the IDF have a liquid explosive that they can basically drill a hole every 100 feet, and they bring in this binary compound in trucks, and which is really, you know, problematic in a war to be bringing trucks of chemicals, but you mix them in the hole basically, so they're not flammable on targeting. But that's one of the ways, but really the primary way that they've used in Gaza is stringing together mines, you know, with blasting cap all along the, you know, 1-2 mile long tunnels, depending on what level of tunnels that they also put them in a strategic tunnel of value, whether it's, you know, in cross operating environment mobility, command and control, to the tactical tunnel, which is like from house to house or something. So they are also prioritizing which ones they use explosives to destroy. But, you know, just as a planner or researcher, to know that challenge has in modern warfare has become a very big challenge, is how do they destroy a tunnel. In the doctrine, there's actually a resource page. So in an earlier version, because it was the asymmetric warfare group that was the lead for writing the doctrine, because they had that as one of their kind of operational requirements, and they had a lot of experts, and they had an asymmetric warfare group tunnel handbook that was really good. That was a big part of, you know, they tried to incorporate it into the doctrine. Earlier versions of the doctrine actually had equipment lists. I'm sure if you reach back to your engineer, you would be able to get this equipment list, but there are, you know, NSN lines for all the equipment you would need, whether it's, you know, breathing apparatuses or torches or things, you know, specifically camo, all of it, lighting, everything. There's an NSN for it because of all this work that was done during that big work project in around the 2017 timeframe. In the manual, it gives you a couple, which I think are good. PCCs, if your mission is attacking into and you know you're going to be attacking into a subterranean environment, like breaching equipment, ballistic shields, really big. Lights, both visible and infrared, because if I didn't mention it, normal night vision doesn't work underground. Unless you have a newer version with IR or other capabilities. You have to have, you know, camo, and there is a mesh network. There is specialized camo that will help, and I've heard of some rudimentary camo helping in modern combat, but there is specialized kind of mesh network specifically designed for the underground, breathing apparatuses or air testing capabilities. Go to your chemical officer and maybe they'll be able to help with that. Ladders, ropes, marking kits, and explosive hazard detection equipment. So those are, it's in the book, but it's a couple resources that just off the top of their head if you're attacking into an underground environment. So one of the last things, because I am a old soldier at heart, so there's always the element of field expedient things. So you found something, and I've done a couple to include with an SF officer, if you go back, about tunnels that you just found and field expedient things that had to be used. And here I listed a couple here that I wanted to mention, which was like the smoke to map, which is problematic because most smoke is not breathable, but for mapping, it has been used. Wire for camo, if you can ever find some it's in the environment. String, so 550 cord for navigation. So there is, even in Afghanistan, both people that were tying strings to soldiers that were moving in the environment, or which is really interesting, when they sent a Talon robot as far as they could get, they had a string where they could pull it back if it got rolled over or whatever. So I thought that was really some creative field expedient things you would have. Winches for logistics. There was a really big, at the old Fort Benning, they had a big underground warfare experiment. One of the things they found they really needed was winches on the vehicles, because as the force maneuvered and then it needed resupply or casual vac, a winch on the front of the vehicle really helped with that. And I was just in Gaza in July and I saw a really creative field expedient exploitation device where they stuck a GoPro on a very long hard pipe and then had a string on it so they could drop it down. And they basically figured out, they had a well they thought was a tunnel, but it ended up just being a well. So those are some interesting field expedient measures for some 101. And then lastly, that challenge of being us, right? The fact that I don't personally think that there will be, I hope, another Gaza situation where that it's only for military purposes, dug underneath the civilians for the use of human shields and to that level and billions of dollars, versus even in Hezbollah, which will have some of that, but has a lot of the for military purpose in mountains and things like that. But the challenge is still us in preparing for this environment, like the fact that we don't incorporate into our defensive plans the awareness of underground and how to use it. So the planning considerations for defending and using the underground in a large scale combat operation against a peer enemy, if we can, the whole rapid maneuver of command and control elements, then we should be considering the protection that the underground provides. Either we make it or it's available in the environment. And there's a lot of old World War II stuff in many parts of the world left over where it's still viable protection. And all these reasons that we talked about in this short podcast about underground warfare 101 or subterranean warfare 101. I hope you took some value out of this, and I didn't talk too fast, but that was a class I gave in California and thought it's kind of the appropriate time as we're seeing a lot of underground warfare right now. And I think it still gives both a great advantage and causes challenges if you're not considering it. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.